forever by my side.
Hey, you're listening to 830 AM KSDP in Sand Point, Alaska.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torta. Octopus have captured the public's attention with their intelligence, ability to change color, and amazing lives. Ever since Alaska Pacific University professor David Shield arrived in Alaska, he has studied octopuses. Starting in Cordova, Alaska, he learned how to scuba dive with them, overcoming his trepidations stemming from historical accounts of giant octopus. He went on to learn how to find and study octopus in Prince William Sound and elsewhere in the world. His book, Many Things Under the Rock, details his career and what he learned from these remarkable creatures. He shares his stories with me on this Outdoor Explorer.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1.
Anchorage has a new ordinance improving parking accessibility for individuals with disabilities. Easy Park offers free street meter parking to recipients of the mobility and disability parking permits, ensuring greater accessibility and convenience for those who qualify, including extended stays at all on-street meter spaces. More info at easyparkalaska.com or at 907-297-4471. This message sponsored by Easy Park.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Torta. Today, we're learning about octopuses, and I have Dr. David Shield, the author of Many Things Under the Rock, The Mysteries of Octopuses, in the studio with me today. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It seems like a topic everybody's interested in nowadays is octopuses.
Yes. It's hasn't it always been that way?
Let's start with the book. Just give us a little overview of the book.
Many Things Under a Rock takes a reader from sort of meeting an octopus and trying to understand what you're looking at through getting to know octopuses until maybe eventually even getting a glimpse of what it's like to be an octopus. And it's my attempt to write an engaging, captivating history of a natural history of these animals, because we talk about them a lot, but we don't often have a very good grounding in what they're actually like in the water. And so I was trying to develop that sense for myself, really, but also to bring the readers along.
They are having their moments, it seems like, in the last couple of years, right?
Yes. It's interesting. We're talking a lot about octopuses in a fun way, and I think that's maybe been promoted by social media. And they're very engaging creatures and often very surprising animals, which I think makes them great sort of fodder for jokes and conversations and internet joy. But then NPR has been doing Cephalopod Week on Science Friday for a long time because they are such interesting creatures scientifically. And then more recently, there's public controversies about how they should be managed, whether they should be eaten, and, you know, questions like that.
Right, yeah, because we all enjoy our calamari and whatever.
Seafood is also having a moment.
Yeah, seafood in general, right.
In general.
Well, tell us a bit about yourself and how you got to be interested in octopuses. You're sort of growing up and academic background, and how did you end up in Alaska?
That covers a lot of ground, Paul.
It does.
I was born in New York State. I grew up rurally in a small town called Grand Island, New York, in the river, in the Niagara River, above Niagara Falls, and went to college in New York, but also grew up in other places. Like I spent some time in New Mexico and in Texas as a kid. And then when I got out of college. I went to graduate school and worked overseas in Serengeti in Tanzania, studying African lions. And after graduate school, like so many people with advanced degrees, I had to find a job. And, you know, I ended up staying on college campuses through a postdoc. But eventually I got a job with the Prince William Sound Science Center in Cordova, Alaska. I had been to Alaska before. I came up here for a school for field studies course in Glacier Bay. This is the first time I'd lived there. And so Cordova sits on the shores of Prince William Sound, an area you're very familiar with. And I was looking for ways to contribute there to the science that the Science Center was doing. I arrived in Cordova 1 month after the fisherman's blockade of the Valdez Narrows in protest of the ways the settlements and legal hullabaloo was shaken out after the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
Yeah.
And so the Prince William Sound Science Center was making a major effort to get involved as a nonprofit and a non-government agency and a non-industry agency in oil spill recovery and understanding. And so one of the things that happened during that whole period was some of the Alaska natives in the communities around the sound were talking about the failure of their subsistence harvest and how difficult it was in the years immediately after the oil spill to know whether what was on the beach was safe to eat, but also to find things that had previously been abundant and now were scarcer. Octopuses was one of those foods that they were concerned about. And so I pitched a proposal at that point to work in the villages and look at octopus abundance. And so portions of that story are told in the early chapters of Many Things Under a Rock. And that's kind of how I got into this. And that was 1995.
Yeah.
So that set the stage for the next 30 years.
It's a long ways from the Serengeti to Cordova. So how do you manage that transition, right? It's not the
just
savanna.
The unfolding of my misspent youth. I considered going back to Africa and doing sort of large mammal predator work there. And I actually got a job offer, but I had to turn it down because it conflicted with my wedding date.
Oh. Yes. That's a good reason to turn the job down.
Yeah, so I had to turn the job down. I couldn't go. Subsequent to that, I had worked in Yellowstone as an undergraduate in the concessions.
Yeah.
And I had always imagined myself going back to work with large predators in Yellowstone. But it turned out, in order to work on the bear recovery team or the wolf reintroduction team in Yellowstone, those are agency-run jobs, and to be an agency biologist, you have to be really well-rounded.
Yeah.
And I had lots of courses in chemistry and molecular biology and genetics, but I didn't have any courses in botany.
Uh-huh.
And so I was not competitive for those jobs. I couldn't get through the sort of first filter. So I ended up doing a postdoc in Texas on climate change and learned geographic information systems.
Yeah.
As I was leaving my PhD program in my last semester, my advisor, Craig Packer, who I'd worked with on the lion studies in the Serengeti, he looked at me and he said, "You need a skill. Take a geographic information systems course."
Yeah.
So I did.
GIS, yeah.
Yeah, GIS. So that course got me my job as a postdoc working in Texas on global climate change. And then that experience got me my job at the Prince William Sound Science Center running their geographic information systems.
Ah, so that was the job there.
So that was the link.
Yeah.
And then from there, I put proposals in to do marine work. And I ended up working on a diversity of things. I published some papers on salmon predation on salmon fry. I did some work on killer whales. I did some work on octopuses, and I did some work on intertidal communities along the shore there.
That's a great lesson for the young students out there in the world, is to have a skill.
You need a skill. Right. Yes. Specifically a marketable skill.
A marketable skill, yeah. Good advice.
These are hard to come by.
Right. So in Cordova, you're now starting Octopus, but you weren't necessarily a marine person, right? You had to develop those skills too.
Yeah. When I came to the Science Center in Cordova, I had no marine experience. I grew up inland. I'd been on the ocean. I think we went to the shore once. I'd seen big lakes. So, yeah. You know, I grew up on the Great Lakes. So I knew big water, but I didn't know the ocean at all. And so I had to learn those skills along the way as well. I transitioned from being a terrestrial predator ecologist to being a marine predator ecologist. But the basics of predation are really very similar.
And you had an interest in octopuses. I think you might have a reading for one of your first encounters. Is that right?
I can read you a little section from the opening of Many Things Under a Rock.
Yeah.
So this is from the introduction, Underwater in Prince William Sound, South Central Alaska. I followed the octopus into the emerald void between the surface and the depths. Above us in sunlight, the water sparkled with tiny glass plankton of some sort. Below us, the light vanished in darkening green over the flats just out of sight. I swam parallel with the octopus, finning hard to match his pace. The octopus was a large juvenile male of perhaps 20 pounds and missing his second right arm. He planed backwards through the water, mantle first, then eyes and head, arms trailing. His web was flattened into a hydrofoil, web membrane extended, stump and three arms above, four arms below. His mantle expanded and then contracted powerfully, expelling the water from his siphon as he jetted over the distant, silted bottom. The octopus pitched his body downward and we descended. He neared the bottom at a depth of about 40 feet and abruptly blanched white. He spread his arms and web wide, then grabbed hold of some of the kelp. White phantasms raced out of his blanched skin, chased by incoming waves of burnt and red ochre. In a second, he matched the surrounding Laminariale's kelp. He pulled a broad kelp blade over his head. "I have disappeared," he seemed to say.
That is so cool. And we'll talk about that, their ability to disappear. And that sort of was one of your first encounters. I think the first encounter was in an aquarium, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And then,
but this was one of my very early underwater encounters.
Right. And so what were you doing in Cordova specifically? You're looking at habitat, abundance, and what was the study?
The early study was to look at, habitat and abundance, to try and just get a handle on what we could say, if anything, about the octopus populations in Prince William Sound, but specifically in connection with Alaskan native subsistence harvest. Mm-hmm. And so I started my research by going subsistence harvesting with people from the villages of Tetitlik, Chiniga Bay, and they caught their octopuses typically by walking the beaches and mm-hmm. looking under rocks. And this is one of the things that leads to the title of the book, Many Things Under a Rock. And that meant that in order to keep that connection with the sort of subsistence harvest view of octopuses, that I started and continued the research by walking beaches at low tide. And so a lot of the work actually happened on land.
Yeah.
Oh, but in marine habitats.
Right, yeah.
And the goals were sort of, how many octopuses are they? Are they easy to find? Are they hard to find? What's the population like? Is it one species or multiple species? Is it mostly male or mostly female? What's the size distribution? Can we find the really little ones that would be too small for subsistence harvest, but would indicate how many octopuses were arriving at the beaches? You know, that's a one particular view of what's going on with octopuses,
right.
But it's one that we could reliably sample.
relate to us the importance of that native knowledge, the indigenous knowledge. And you were out there with elders, I suppose, and people collecting.
Well, Alaska as a state has more coastline, I think, than the entire lower 48. And Prince William Sound itself has an immense amount of coastline. Do you know how many miles of coastline in Prince William Sound?
2,000. It's quite a bit. Yeah,
it's 2,000 miles of coastline.
Yeah.
So without the Alaska natives having just arrived from the wilds of Serengeti and never seen the ocean before, I would not have known how to begin searching 2,000 miles of coastline for one of the most hard to see, best camouflaged animals on the planet.
Yeah.
Right? So one of the things that came out immediately or in the very first year of looking at what I had learned from the Alaska natives is you find the octopuses in the kelp zones. I would not have started searching in the kelp zones because there's a lot of kelp there, a lot of places to hide. So that's why the octopuses are there. And that's why if you want to see, find, collect, or investigate octopuses, you have to start thinking about the world from the point of view of the octopus. So one way to do that is to get into their habitats and take a look at what are they seeing and what are they finding. And that's kind of the journey I try and take the reader on in Many Things Under a Rock, is if we start with, you know, the naive perspective of I've seen my first octopus, and then gradually we immerse ourselves first in their habitats and then in their bodies, and I hope eventually in their minds and their communities.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Torlak. We're talking about octopuses with Dr. David Shield. So then you got into diving, and you wrote in the book some concerns about the size of octopus and some of the stories out there of people of large octopus, right? So, and specifically, you were looking at the giant Pacific octopus. Is that correct?
Yeah, the giant Pacific
octopus.
And
that sounds sort of, you know, intimidating in itself, giant. Yeah.
So this is the largest species of octopus in the world. And so two things happened in that first year when I arrived in Cordova. I went down to the Cordova bookstore one day, and I picked up a copy of this book that was telling stories of adventures, near-death experiences in Alaska.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, they had pilots who had crashed in the mountains and, had to survive, and they had boats that had foundered and sunk and all these kinds of
classic
bear encounters,
oh, bears, of course, yeah.
You know, all the classic dangers of Alaska, because this can be a adventuresome state to live in. And one of the chapters, Harvester of Kelp, I believe, is down, you know, 30 or 40 feet down on a hookah diving gear, which is surface supplied air. So he's got a hose that's pumping the air down to him so he can breathe. And he finds an octopus that reaches out and wraps an arm around his leg. And the rest of the story, which goes on for hours, is how he is finally able to escape the octopus because it's holding him underwater. Now, I'm reading this. It appeared in my life when I'd already trained to be a scuba diver, but I hadn't taken any dives beyond the 4 certification dives that you take, right? So I'm learning to be a good enough diver to dive in Alaska, where you have to do cold water diving and no dry suit training, and to dive as a scientist. So you have to have rescue diving and first aid and all of the risk management things that we do. And so I'm reading this story in that mindset, as I'm preparing to take a team of divers on my first marine expedition underwater to look for giant Pacific octopuses. So that's one story I read. Second story I read was from Florida, 1890s, I believe, when a giant carcass washes up after a storm in St. Augustine, Florida, and is identified by a doctor who finds it on the beach there as an octopus weighing several tons.
Wow.
And he sends some photographs of this carcass to the Smithsonian Institution. And the scientist there, A.E. Verrill, publishes an account of the colossal octopus weighing,
bigger than giant, the colossal
octopus. So this story lives on into the current day as the largest octopus ever documented by science, overlooking the fact that the doctor in Florida then cuts off some tissue samples and sends them to A.E. Verrill. But because they take a few more weeks to arrive, they arrive a little bit later. And Verrill opens them at the Smithsonian, and up comes the scent that he's very familiar with of rancid whale oil. And he immediately knows this tissue came from some sort of dead whale. And it, all the bones had fallen out of it as it rotted at sea. All of the skin had come off. All of the identifying markers were gone. It was just a big sack of tissue and some tendrils that looked vaguely octopus-like. So he immediately, in 1890, publishes a second paper retracting the identification of this carcass as Octopus giganteus. So in the literature, this mistake lived for a month.
Right.
But in legend,
it goes on.
It's 150 years now, you know.
But there are big ones out there, right?
Like there are big ones. The giant Pacific octopus easily gets over 100 pounds. And there's a really believable, well-documented, solid record of 156 pounds. And then some increasingly tenuous records up to 400 or 600 pounds. So I didn't know at the time that those were increasingly tenuous records. I'm kind of still working on the story of those larger records and what's going on with them. But I recount a lot of that in the book. And even a 156-pound octopus underwater, lined with suckers, armed with a tearing beak, and possibly, who knows how aggressive it might be, is something to consider when you're asking divers to go down, engage with this animal, try and collect it so you can bring it to the surface and weigh it.
So how did you manage that? What was the advice from someone how to manage?
Yeah, so I'm reading from a section I wrote discussing a meeting we had before our first trip out. And we're learning from Michael Kite, who's had collected octopuses for aquarium trade in the past and was brought up as an accountant or a consultant. Michael gave us a rundown on octopuses, how to handle them underwater. He introduced us to octopus life history, familiar to me from my reading, and then he briefed us on his methods and techniques for capturing octopuses. This is for the divers now. I'll be down there with you, so I want you both to know what to do at the right time. Checking that he had their attention, Michael looked first at Dan and then at Neil. Michael went over the basics of how to identify a den, how to approach from above and behind so that the diver did not stir up silt and the octopus did not get agitated, and how to scoop the octopus as it is moving out of the den before it has a chance to grab hold of some rocks. Once it's got a hold of the bottom, you're not going to be able to pull it up without injuring it, he said. So it's important to scoop it free of the bottom quickly and then handle it in mid-water. Tanya, Kathleen, and I were new divers without the experience of Neil, Dan, and Michael. For a beginning diver, one of the most difficult tasks is to maintain neutral buoyancy so that you can work in the water column, neither popping to the surface like a cork nor dropping to the bottom in a dense cloud of silt. We novices glanced at one another, faintly intimidated at the thought of having to juggle an octopus and maintain neutral buoyancy at the same time. Once you've got it off the bottom, Michael continued, then you can point it body first into the bag, and it will glide right in. Now, if we get a really big one, Michael paused, I'll handle it. But everybody needs to know what to do in case there are problems. It can be more difficult to scoop a 100-pound octopus off the bottom than one that is only 5 or 10 pounds. The trick with the larger octopuses, according to Michael, was to keep pushing them up and away from the bottom and turn them head over beak again and again. Eventually, feeling harassed, the octopus would adopt a defensive posture, curling its arms over its body and forming into a ball without all the suckers facing out. In such a pose, arms held close to the body, an octopus will not be holding on to much, and the diver can more easily scoop it into the bag. Now, even the experienced divers seem faintly impressed at the thought of juggling a 100-pound octopus in midwater. Of course, with the big ones, Michael went on, you have to be a little concerned about letting the octopus get a hold of you. Even a medium-sized one is strong enough to pull your mask off or to take your regulator away.
Great.
But you can't really get into trouble unless... I fleetingly wondered here what Michael considered trouble, if not an octopus stealing a diver's mask and regulator. You can't really get into trouble unless the octopus is larger, in which case if it gets wrapped around you, it can pin your arms to your sides and you won't be able to retrieve your mask. Of course, that's not really serious, Michael added. But if it has taken your regulator while your arms are pinned. I began to see where Michael got his sliding scale of severity for trouble. Although drowning with your arms free did not seem that much preferable to drowning with them pinned.
But you're still here.
I'm still here. I didn't drown.
All your cohorts are still here, I assume. So yeah.
Yeah, we haven't lost any divers. Yeah,
that's exciting.
On octopus capture, yeah, right. Which is good.
Right. And you're capturing them, weighing them, and then what do you do?
Weigh them, identify their sex, look for signs of scars, battles, good and bad health, and then we release them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. We have a few minutes before the break here. How about a brief overview of the life cycle of an octopus?
Yeah, so the eggs are laid usually under a rock or in a cavern that the mother sort of creates and maintains. And then she tends the eggs as they develop. And during this period, she's a very devoted mother, doesn't leave the eggs, stops feeding, keeps them algae-free, keeps predators away, keeps them well oxygenated. Eventually, they hatch and the young swim up into the plankton. They tend to live near the surface, and they develop in the plankton for some period of time, depending on the species and so on and so forth. And then they settle to the bottom, where they develop as juveniles for a period of some time. Giant Pacific octopuses will be a year, 2 years, 3 years. When they reach a large enough size, they sexually mature. The males start wandering around looking for mates. And once the males and females have mated, the females can store the sperm until they're ready to fertilize their eggs and have them develop and lay the eggs.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Twilight. We're talking about octopuses with Dr. David Seale. We'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1, connecting Alaskans, life informed.
When you need more than just a headline, you can rely on Alaska Insight to provide the complete picture. Join me, Lori Townsend, as my guests and I go beyond the headlines to provide you with important context on state politics, public safety, the state's changing economy, arts, sciences, culture, and a lot more. Join us for meaningful conversations about the issues that matter most to Alaskans.
Friday night at 7 on Alaska Public Media Television.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordat. We're talking about octopuses with Dr. David Shield on Alaska Public Media. So, David, in the book, you have a section about native names and stories. And I think the name of the book is sort of an interpretation of one of those names. Is that correct?
Yeah. When I first arrived in Alaska, one of the engaging and kind of amazing and curious things about Alaska was the very vibrant Native Alaskan cultures, and very diverse too. And as I mentioned, I was working with Alaska Natives to look at their subsistence harvest and understand where and how they were finding and working with octopuses. And so, you know, it was a very natural question, like, well, what is the word for octopus? And I was living in Cordova at the time, and a lot of Alaskan Native languages have gone through a period of sort of suppression and then near extinction and now resurgence. And so at the time that I was in Cordova, Marie Smith was the last surviving native speaker of Iyak, the native language of Iyak. And so it seemed intriguing, at least, to learn the Iyak word for octopus, which is salaksguk. But one of the questions that then follows on that is, well, what does that mean? Is it a word that stands all by itself, or is it a composite or a story or some sort of word that has translation even in its own language? And so it really means many things under a rock, which I thought was just kind of humorous because, you know, an octopus is one thing, but it's got all those arms and all those suckers, and they're kind of, when you encounter a nice, active, healthy octopus, they're kind of all over the place. So it's kind of many things in one. And so I chose that as the title for the book, in part to honor that, but also because in working with octopuses, I ended up having to learn about a huge diversity of things that were all entailed under this rock. You know, I ended up investigating 100-year-old stories of dead whales and how they got that way. And I ended up having to learn starfish and figure out what they were eating because it wasn't clear to me who was digging the holes that I sometimes found as possible sign of octopuses. And I ended up taking a trip to the Alaska Native Language Center in Fairbanks and asking Michael Krauss there about the words for octopus in Alaska Native languages, which led to trying to understand how Alaska Native peoples had come into Alaska eons ago and how they had interacted over the intervening periods, and how in Prince William Sound is sort of this meeting, an area that has been the meeting grounds for diverse cultures. So that on the east side of Prince William Sound, the Alaskan native word in Iyak for octopus is salaksguk, which means many things under a rock. On the west side of Prince William Sound, the Aleutic name for octopus is amaguk, which is derived from indigenous words for skin. And it's rooted in sort of getting at this really amazing skin of the octopuses, because they have a lot of skin. And unlike, well, maybe like humans, but in many ways, they do a lot of very diverse things with their skin. It's very changeable. And it's the most important organ for them in organizing their camouflage responses.
That's fascinating. Let's go to their underwater world now. What's under the rock? And like we talked a little bit in the first half, the end of the first half, about their life cycle, but I'm interested in their senses. Like, let's talk about their skin a little bit and how that is important and differs from our skin in some ways, right?
Yeah. So octopus skin is under their voluntary control, if you will, and it's comprised of multiple layers of colored cells called chromatophores, and the chromatophores themselves are revealed or hidden by muscles. And so they can, that's how they can change color in a fraction of a second. It's much faster than a chameleon change of color, which is regulated in part by blood flow and hormones and things like that. The octopus, it's largely under neural control that activates muscles, and it can happen as fast as you can make a gesture with your fingers or something like that. And then they also can change the texture of their skin.
Yeah, that's so cool.
So when it's relaxed, it's very smooth and covered with a layer of slime and, you know, kind of like almost like a frog skin maybe. But then they can make it bumpy or raise tessellations or raise papillae. And then the final sort of layer of their camouflage, they have color, they have skin texture, and then they also have body posture. So they can raise their arms and imitate the movements of kelp in the water or things like that.
And that helps them hide.
And that helps them. It makes them really hard to spot.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really hard to spot.
Now, so that's sort of their skin. Do they, and they have suckers on the skin. What's the difference between a male and a female?
Yeah, so the octopuses have, the giant Pacific octopus in particular, has two rows of suckers down each arm. So right from the mouth, which is underneath the crown of arms, beneath the web, all the way out to the tips of the arms, there are two rows of suckers. They sort of get fat. They're tiny suckers near the mouth. Then they get fatter as they go away from the mouth, sort of mid-arm. And then they get smaller again, the suckers do as they reach the arm tip, because the arm tapers towards the tip anyway. So if you, the arms are in pairs from the front of the octopus, the first pair, right and left, second pair, right and left, third pair, fourth pair. So if you look at the suckers at the tip of the third right arm of the octopus, if the suckers go all the way to the tip, getting smaller and smaller, but all the way out to the tip, then you have a female octopus. On the males, the suckers give way partway out, and there's a smoother organ called the hectocotylus. And that is used by the male to pass sperm packets to the female during mating. The only challenge is the males in particular don't like it when you inspect their third right arm to see whether there's suckers to the tip. And so they're very careful to hide it.
Uh-huh.
And so even if you've got the octopus in a bag and you're, you know, got a little bit of water there and you're just trying to find that third right arm, you know, you sort of sort from between the eyes, you go down between the eyes, you find the base of the first right arm, base of the second right arm, base of the third right arm, and then you try and follow it out to the tip, but the males are like, nope, and just tuck it back underneath and kind of try and keep it away from you. So I tell the students, they come to me and they say, well, I looked at one octopus, I could tell it was a female, but the second octopus won't let me look at its arm. I'm like, well, it's probably a male.
Yeah. The arms, I thought this was fascinating, have their sort of own neurological thing going on. Do I understand that right, or a little independent?
Yeah, so this has been one of these areas of discussion amongst scientists and philosophers. The brain of the octopus is located in the head, below and slightly behind the eyes. And it consists of a sort of a central brain, which actually forms in a ring around the esophagus, two big optic lobes, and then the brain communicates out to all of the arms. So each arm has a major nerve cord running down the center of the arm. But if you look at the, you know, if you ask, well, how big is the brain? Well, it turns out that about one third of the neurons of the entire octopus are located in the brain. Two-thirds are distributed out around the body. And that sounds really dramatic. And so at one point I was like, well, I got to figure out how does that compare to a human? Like, what's the corresponding number for us? We have a major cord that runs down our spine, and then from that it radiates out, and we have nerves all throughout our body. So I thought, well, maybe it's not as dramatic as it sounds. No, 98% of neurons in the human body originate in the brain.
Wow.
Compared to one-third for an octopus. So it really is this very distributed nervous system. And some biologists have thought, well, okay, But why? What's going on out in the body that it has all of these nerves out there? One answer is, well, each sucker has a little ganglion and each arm has a big ganglion and each pair of suckers has a little ganglion. So you go, suckers are innervated. They go to a nerve cluster at the base of each sucker, which goes to a nerve cluster at the base of each sucker pair, which communicates with the main axes running along the length of the arm, which is a little bit like our spinal cord, but they have eight of them. And then that communicates to another nerve cluster up at the base of all of the arms. All of that happens outside of the brain. But other people have thought, well, can the arms learn independently of the brain? Can the arms take action independently of the brain? So my general sense after reviewing all of that is that, well, possibly they are biologically capable of that, but it doesn't make any ecological sense. Like if your left foot is not in agreement with the rest of you, you know, you're going to have problems. And so, so the evolutionarily and cognitively, the octopus really needs to function as a unified individual. So it wouldn't make a lot of sense for independent centers of cognition to arise throughout the arms. But the arms, nevertheless, are capable of executing a lot of action that the brain normally just inhibits.
Uh-huh.
So when the brain is not inhibiting the action, the octopus default is to pass things, each sucker to latch onto things, recruit the neighboring sucker, and pass it towards the mouth. So if the octopus isn't paying attention, it's going to capture things, send it on into the mouth.
Right.
So the brain normally has to inhibit that.
It'd be like our hands, like, you know, I'm talking to you and also my hand wanders off to my coffee and, you know, grabs a drink.
And without grabs me a really drink of coffee, without you actually deciding I'm going to sip my coffee, but you do it anyway.
What about other things like sight and touch, other senses? They have smell, for instance?
Yeah, so the octopuses are very visual animals, big eyes prominently located on the head, a lot of processing power in the brain, visual processing. And there's two things they're really doing with their visual processing. They are identifying other agents, animals moving around in the environment. What's going on? Is that a possible food? Is that a possible predator? And then they're also... they're matching the texture and the darkness and lightness of their surroundings for camouflage. So those are big, big jobs that the eyes have to do. This. What else is out there and is it important to me? And how do I hide? They also, you asked about taste and smell. Yeah. They have chemical receptors located predominantly in the suckers. They occur other places in the body, but the sucker rims are very important. They have two kinds, sort of a touch taste receptor that responds to substrates that come in contact with the sucker rim. So as they're walking along the bottom, they are touching it and feeling it by mechanical reception, but they're also sampling it chemically. So they're tasting it as they walk along on their suckers. And then they also have distance chemoreceptors, as it were. It's not really distance, but more akin to our smell than our taste, in that they're detecting water-soluble molecules that are floating in the ocean around them.
Well, that's a lot going on in the process.
There's a lot of
suckers that are wandering around, feeling stuff at one time, and
Yeah, all from something like 2,000 suckers.
Wow.
And then each sucker rim has, you know, many thousand receptors. And, you know, the arm can process the desirability, whether something's like desirable or noxious, without any reference to the brain. And it can try and take action to avoid or bring in something that it's tasted or smelled chemically.
This is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Torta. We're talking to David Shield about octopuses. He's the author of Many Things Under the Rock. David, so we talked about some of the senses. What about how sociable are they? I think my impression is they're very pretty solitary animals.
Yeah, Octopuses have long had a reputation as very solitary animals that often will be aggressive towards their own kind. So, you know, people talk about the fact that if an octopus's account is another octopus's, there's really only two options. You're either going to mate or cannibalism.
Yeah, the being, yeah.
Right. So you know, that's been a very sort of influential impression of how octopuses are. But over the last 15 years or so, scientists have made some discoveries that sort of counter this notion that the octopus really doesn't have any capacity to cope with its own kind, except as mate or food. And so the book, Many Things Under a Rock, I try and lead the reader through this kind of developing sense of maybe the octopus has these other capacities, these social capacities, as you will, that we haven't seen yet. And this wouldn't be like a wolf or a lion or a killer whale, where the social connections are made through family lines. Mothers raise their young, and the young then interact with each other and with the mothers, all of their own kind, during rearing. Because in the octopuses, when the mother's tending the eggs, they're just a little developing in the egg, and they don't have any capacity for interaction. And then they disperse on the waves.
Yeah.
And so this is a different kind of capacity to engage with your own kind that is sort of found companions along the way. And so what tends to happen, I did some work in Jervis Bay, Australia. This is a place south of Sydney, down at 60 feet depth or so, and there's a lot of food around, really, really rich scallop beds in this area, but there's very little shelter. And so there's this site there called Octopolis. And what's unique about this site is that it's an aggregation of dens, of shelter, where octopuses can live, but the shelter forces them to be very close together, we think. And so what happens there is these octopuses are interacting with one another almost constantly. So you have 16 or so octopuses on the site when it's really densely occupied, and you'll see thousands of interactions a day.
So it's possible.
Yeah, so it does happen, and we see all kinds of things. You know, they're a little bit jostling and giving each other a little bit of a hard time and trying to, you know, get some space and keep their den clean. And there's a lot of different things going on. We've seen one male octopus evict other males from the dens and try and keep them off the site. Females trying to keep males either at a distance or react to their mating attempts. We see octopuses sort of throwing silt and shells at one another to try and just get them to back off a little bit, give them a little more space.
Yeah.
So lots of interactions that are not directly related to mating, nor are they all out kill or be killed aggression.
But you have a nice story in there about the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis, and a researcher biologist who thought, oh, octopuses might be helpful to JFK and his crew. You want to relate about that?
Yeah, periodically, I do these like just random searches for things with octopuses in the title just to try and keep up on the literature. And I found this book about communication and the octopus. And I was like, this is kind of weird. And I looked at the summary, and it was all about sort of theories of communication. But it obviously had a major section about octopuses. And so I had to buy it and figure out what's going on. And so in that book, there's this story being related from the 60s, maybe late 50s, early 60s, about a researcher who was a communication expert. And so he wanted to look at how solitary things communicate, because what he was interested in was the problem of how nations should get along with one another. And he definitely wanted to get away from that notion of parents and offspring. So he didn't want to understand how England gets along with the United States, for example. He wanted to know how, like, neighbors get along with you. Like, how does the United States get along with Mexico or, you know, Fiji, right? And so he wanted to get some octopuses and force them to be together and see what happens. So he collected some octopuses from California, and he kept them in groups of two or three. You know, sometimes he got this all-out aggression.
Yeah.
And sometimes he got other stuff. But he was not interested in octopus biology, and he never published this work. And so it only came to light when this scholar unearthed his archives and things like that. But what did happen is, as he was doing this work, the Soviet missile crisis, the Cuban missile crisis, came to light, in which the Soviets had placed some rockets and launch capacity in Cuba. And President Kennedy was contesting with, trying to decide, what am I going to do with this during the, you know, whatever it was, so many days of the Cuban Missile Crisis, how to deal with this. And so Bateman, the guy who was the scholar interested in communication, decided he needed to write a letter to President Kennedy's science advisors and say, look, you can take a lesson from octopuses about how to communicate with Khrushchev about the Cuban Missile Crisis to bring it to a non-deadly resolution. In other words, it doesn't have to be kill or be killed. And he, so he wrote this letter and he sent it off to someone that he hoped could get it to President Kennedy's attention through his science advisors. Now, the Cuban Missile Crisis was resolved within a couple of days of Bateman sending this letter. So historically, it probably didn't have any impact on Kennedy's decisions, probably never reached him. But from the point of view of understanding octopuses, it's just an incredible little story.
That's really interesting. So what does an octopus have to worry about down there?
Lots of predators. You know, they're soft-bodied animals with no shells, no outer protective shells, and no bones.
So they're cephalopod, right?
Yeah, the cephalopods. And they are, they're just a nice, the octopuses are just a nice package of protein for a predator. And so basically, as they grow larger, you know, anything that can eat them will. When they're little, that's almost everything. Salmon, herring, you know, pretty much anything in the plankton will attack and eat a small octopus. By the time we're kind of seeing them in our study and they're 1 to 2 pounds and larger and they're down on the beach, they have to worry about dogfish shark and big halibut and seals and sea lions and otters and birds possibly. Pretty much anything that can get at them will. And that's where their incredible camouflage capabilities that we've already talked a little bit about really come in. And what they do when they're camouflaged is they pick something in the environment to resemble. And they look a lot like that. And so the giant Pacific octopus really resembles those slightly reddish laminarial kelps, the big brown leaf kelps that are all over the near shore in Prince William Sound.
Yeah.
Many, many different species. But to the casual eye, they all have a certain similarity, kind of a big reddish brown and swaying in the waves. And the octopus puts some ripples on its skin that look a little bit like that, and it's got the reddish brown color and just adopts that look.
Yeah.
And they can be really hard to pick out, even if you know they're there. You
know? And they have the ink too, right?
They have a the ink cloud. When they're trying to escape, they will ink and then change directions.
Yeah.
And so I relate one of the stories in Many Things Under a Rock. I relate the story of an octopus. This one was in Hawaii. That was filmed in a battle with a moray eel.
Oh, right.
And at the end of that battle, the octopus escapes the grasp of the moray eel and jets away, and it leaves, I think, three consecutive ink clouds spaced about a meter apart as it's swimming away. And the moray eel whips around to try and re-grasp the octopus. And instead of attacking the octopus, the moray actually attacks the second of those three ink clouds. And by the time the moray has bitten the empty ink cloud and sort of shaken that taste out of its mouth, the octopus is just impossible to find. And it's hit the ground already, changed color, it's just gone.
And do we know what the ink is?
Yeah, it's melanin.
Okay.
It's the same thing that we develop in our skin when we tan or when we have dark skin, and mucus.
So that's what's after them. What are they after? What are they feeding on?
They are feeding on crabs. Crustaceans are one of their preferred foods, and mollusks, bivalves usually. But they eat a huge diversity of things. There was this fascinating study that came out, you know, some years ago about the diversity of resources that native Alaskans used from the intertidal in the Aleutians. And I think it was 60-some species out of the intertidal, based on analyzing 5,000 years of data from the middens left from Alaska Native communities, archaeological data. And in about 10 years, I think, of our data collecting the middens left by octopuses and inventorying the items, they throw the remains of their prey, goes outside of their den, they just discard it. Yeah. And so because they're eating prey with shells on them, we can pick up the shells and figure out what they're eating. So looking at that, we had more species that the octopus were eating from the intertidal alone than in 5,000 years of data from the Alaska Native communities. So the study in the Aleutians had proclaimed humans as sort of super predators, super generalists that basically eat everything. And the octopus had them beat in 10 years.
Wow. And I found it interesting that their sort of techniques. So they have their arms and they have their suckers, but they also like drill holes in the clams. Is that right?
Yeah, they have three ways of, like, if you imagine an octopus with a clam, I relate such a story again in the book, trying to open a clam. Their first way to do it is just to lay the suckers down on the clam and just try and pull it apart. But that is not always successful. Sometimes the clam is stronger than the octopus. So the second technique they can try and do is they use their radula and scrape through and drill a little hole in there. And then the third technique that they can try is to use their beak and chip a little hole. And then once they get it open, even a tiny bit, they can introduce cephalotoxins and enzymes to begin the digestion of the prey and kill it. And then they can pull it open and eat it.
So much to talk about, and we're running out of time. One thing I do want to notice is your daughter did the drawings in the book. Is that right?
Yes. My daughter, Laurel Scheel, did these wonderful line drawings that begin every single chapter. And there's a young reader edition of Many Things Under a Rock, The Mysteries of Octopus. And not only does it have all of the drawings that Laurel did for this book, but it also has some additional new drawings done specifically for the Young Readers Edition of Many Things Under a Rock.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us, David.
My pleasure. What a treat.
I've been talking with David Shields. He's a professor of environmental science at Alaska Pacific University, where you have aquariums with octopus in it, I believe. Yeah.
I do, always happy to have students inquiring about ways to work with the octopus.
Yeah, right. A very popular tour de pub. You have been listening to Outdoor Explorer in Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Torda. Thanks to my guest, David Shields, author of Many Things Under a Rock. Also, thanks to our producer, Tobin Shelby, with additional help from Ammon Swenson. I'm your host, Paul Torduck, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explore, check out what's in a tide pool near you, and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Programming on KSDP is supported by the Schumigan Corporation. Located in Sand Point, the Schumigan family of businesses includes property and equity management, the Sand Point Tavern, the Anchor Inn Motel, and the Anchor Inn Lounge. The Shumigin Corporation, serving its shareholders and the people of Sandpoint, on the web at www.shumigin.com or by telephone at 907-383-3525. The Shumigin Corporation, hometown values and service, a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in